Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Welcome, everyone, to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a big one, a really fascinating, maybe even unsettling piece of literature, Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know what some of you might be thinking, tiny people, giants. The stuff of kids' cartoons, maybe.
Right, the sort of sanitized version.
Exactly. But, well, prepare yourselves, because underneath all that, there's this incredibly sharp, savage critique, really.
Yeah.
Of human nature, society, even the whole idea of Enlightenment progress.
It's biting stuff.
It really is. Swift, you know, he was an Anglo-Irish cleric, a political writer back in the early 18th century, lived through some turbulent times.
And you can feel that turmoil in the writing, can't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He had this, let's say, deeply skeptical view of humanity.
Yeah.
And this book, published in 1726, it looks like a travel adventure on the surface.
But it's so much more. It was aimed squarely at the follies he saw all around him.
Precisely. So, our mission today in this deep dive is to go beyond that surface level. We want to unpack Swift's genius, follow the journey of Lemuel Gulliver, his transformation is key, and really grapple with the big, sometimes uncomfortable ideas that make this book still feel so relevant.
Yeah, what's really ingenious about it is how Swift uses that fantasy, that travelogue format, as a kind of Trojan horse.
Mm.
Inside is the savage critique of his own time, but amazingly, it still hits home today. It's quite something how many people back then just read it as a fun story.
They missed the point.
Well, or maybe the satire was just that well disguised. It speaks to his skill, right? And Gulliver himself, he starts off as this sort of ordinary guy, believes in his own culture.
The typical Englishman abroad, almost?
Kind of. And watching his disillusionment, well, that's the engine Swift uses to take apart our own assumptions.
That's a great way to put it. Swift wasn't just telling a story. It felt more like he was waging a philosophical battle, you know?
Yeah.
But wrapped up in adventure. And to really get Swift, you have to remember his background. Dean of St. Patrick's in Dublin. Defending Irish rights against England. He was right in the thick of political and religious fights.
Yeah, that context is crucial.
So his critique, it wasn't just negativity for its own sake. It felt more like a really harsh moral wake-up call. Like he was screaming, look at yourselves, aim for reason, for virtue, even if you thought we'd probably fail.
Right. It's like holding up one of those funhouse mirrors to society, you know? Everything's distorted.
But the distortion shows the truth more clearly.
Exactly. He mixes the fun with the lesson, using exaggeration and parody to expose all the hypocrisy and rationality he saw everywhere. Politics, science, the lot.
And the narrative voice is so clever. It sounds straightforward. Gulliver just reporting things.
But underneath, layers upon layers. And Gulliver himself often ends up looking ridiculous without even realizing it. That's the genius, isn't it? That so many people just enjoyed the ride without seeing the bite.
Okay, so let's dive into that ride. Where does it start? The first voyage.
Right. So, our man Gulliver, the ship surgeon, practical guy, he gets shipwrecked, washes up on Lilliput.
The famous scene.
The iconic scene, yeah. Wakes up tied down by hundreds of these tiny six-inch people. They call him the Man Mountain.
Ah.
But Swift immediately uses this to start the satire. Lilliput is basically a mini Europe. Obsessed with completely trivial arguments.
And this is where the scale becomes just brilliant, isn't it? It's not just that they're small. Their conflicts seem small because they are small.
Absolutely.
It makes you think, how many of our own big political fights would look just as silly from, well, Gulliver's perspective?
Or from Swift's, like the political parties, the high heels and low heels.
Right. Distinguished only by their shoe heels. It's such an obvious but hilarious dig at the Tories and Whigs in England at the time.
He just cuts right through the pretense, doesn't he?
Totally. And the religious war over eggs.
Oh, the big Endians versus the little Endians. It sounds comical, but it's a devastating take on the Catholic-Protestant conflicts that caused so much bloodshed.
The quote about it is amazing. It began upon the following occasion. It is allowed on all hands that the primitive way of breaking eggs was upon the larger end. But his present majesty's grandfather, while he was a boy, happened to cut one of his fingers, whereupon the emperor, his father, published an edict commanding all his subjects to break the smaller end of their eggs.
It just lays bare the absurdity of dogma leading to war. So simple, so brutal.
And Gulliver gets caught up in it all. He helps him at first, captures the enemy fleet.
Yeah, he gains favor. But then he refuses to completely enslave the enemy, Blefuscu. He shows a bit of mercy, maybe.
And what happens?
He's charged with treason. for not being ruthless enough. He has to flee for his life.
So even the giant man mountain is brought down by petty politics.
Exactly. Swift saying these tiny minds and their tiny quarrels can undo anyone. It's a pretty bleak view of politics.
Okay, so he escapes Lilliput. We're next.
Next stop, Brobdingnag, land of the giants.
So a complete opposite experience.
Yeah. Totally inverted. Now he's the tiny one, about 6 inches tall to their 60 feet. He gets found by a farmer, treated like a pet.
Like a little ball.
Pretty much, yeah. Then he's sold to the queen, becomes a curiosity at court, and life is suddenly full of physical dangers. Giant wasps, a monkey carries him off, nearly drowns in a cream jug.
Sounds terrifying, actually.
It is. But the real core of this part is his conversations with the king of Brobdingnag.
The wise king.
Very wise, very rational. And Gulliver, still proud of his European background, tries to impress the king, tells him all about English politics, wars, law, science. Our greatness.
And the king's reaction.
That's the kicker. He's not impressed at all. He's disgusted.
You're disgusting.
Utterly. After hearing Gulliver's descriptions, he concludes that Europeans sound like creatures driven by greed, hypocrisy, fighting, lying. Just awful.
Ouch. That must have hit Gulliver hard.
It's the first major blow to his pride, his whole worldview. The king delivers probably the most famous line in the book.
The odious vermin line.
That's the one. I cannot but conclude the bulk of your natives to be the most pernicious race of little odious vermin that nature ever suffered to crawl upon the surface of the earth.
Wow. Just wow.
It's devastating, isn't it? Swift uses this giant, seemingly superior perspective to just condemn humanity outright. It forces Gulliver and us to see ourselves through these critical alien eyes, a real turning point.
It really is. That condemnation just hangs there. So where does Gulliver go from Brobdingnag? What's the third voyage?
The third voyage is a bit different. His ship gets attacked by pirates, and he's rescued by the people of Laputa.
The Flying Island.
The Flying Island, yeah. Now, the Laputans are strange. They're obsessed with really abstract maths and music, super intellectual, but completely useless in practical terms. Their clothes don't fit. Their houses are wonky. They're so lost in thought, they need servants, flappers, to gently hit them with sticks to get their attention.
Seriously? Flappers?
Yep. It's Swift making fun of, you know, theoretical science or philosophy that's totally detached from real life, from human needs.
Okay, I see. Knowledge for its own sake, gone too far.
Exactly. And below Laputa, on the mainland, Balnibarbi, it gets even worse. There's the Grand Academy of Legato.
Ah, the projectors.
The infamous projectors. These guys are trying the most absurd experiments, trying to get sunbeams out of cucumbers, turn human waste back into food.
While the country around them is falling apart from neglect.
Precisely. It's a brilliant satire of pointless projects and innovation that doesn't actually help anyone. Then he visits Glubdubdrib.
Where he meets ghosts.
Yeah, summons ghosts of famous historical figures and learns history is basically lies written by the winners. Another layer of disillusionment.
He's piling on.
And then Lugnag, where he encounters the Struldbrugs.
The immortals. That sounds good, maybe.
You'd think. But they're not eternally young. They just keep aging forever. They become senile, diseased, miserable, a burden to everyone. Immortality is a curse.
Good grief. That's dark.
It's incredibly dark. And again, it's Swift attacking shallow human desires. We might wish for immortality, but have we thought it through?
Yeah, that quote about them really makes you think. The question, therefore, was not whether a man would choose to be always in the prime of youth, but how he would pass a perpetual life under all the usual disadvantages which old age brings along with it.
Exactly. It cuts right through that fantasy. So this whole third voyage is really Swift questioning the Enlightenment's blind faith in reason and progress, isn't it?
It seems like it. He's asking, can we get so lost in our own heads and our theories and projects that we lose touch with reality? With what actually matters. The Struldbrugs are like the ultimate dead end of that.
A horrifying dead end. Which sets us up perfectly for the fourth and final voyage. The darkest one.
The land of the Winims.
Right. Gulliver's crew mutinies this time, just abandons him. And he finds himself in a land ruled by horses.
Talking horses.
Talking horses, yes. The Winims, they are the embodiment of pure reason, logic, virtue, perfectly rational, calm, truthful. Their language literally has no words for lying or evil.
Okay. And who else is there?
The Yahoos.
Ah. And they are.
They are. Well, they look human. But they're disgusting, brutish creatures. Filthy, greedy, lustful, violent, pure animal instinct, utterly irrational.
Then Gulliver's reaction.
Absolute horror. Because he looks at the Yahoos, and then he looks at himself. and he's forced to see the resemblance. He realizes these creatures are the raw, unvarnished form of humanity, including himself.
Oh, man. That's the core of it, isn't it?
That's the absolute core. He comes to despise the Yahoos and, by extension, humanity. And he starts to worship the Houyhnhnms, these rational horses. He tells his Houyhnhnm master all about human society.
And the master is not impressed, I take it.
Less than unimpressed. The Houyhnhnm concludes that humans are just Yahoos who've somehow got a bit of reason.
Which only makes us worse.
Exactly. Reason just helps us find more clever ways to be vicious and destructive. And Gulliver completely agrees by this point. He develops this profound misanthropy, this hatred for his own species.
This is definitely the bleakest part. That moment Swift describes when Gulliver sees his reflection.
Yeah. My horror and astonishment are not to be described when I observed in this abominable animal a perfect human figure. I came to behold my figure in a lake and was ready to swoon with horror, for I could not distinguish my face from that of a Yahoo.
It's shattering. It destroys his whole sense of self, his connection to humanity. It solidifies that dark conclusion Swift seems to be pushing towards.
It really does. It forces you, the reader, to ask, what are we, really, beneath the surface? Are we just Yahoos with better clothes and fancier words?
A deeply uncomfortable question.
Yeah.
What happens to Gulliver in the end?
Well, ironically, the Houyhnhnms decide he can't stay. He's too much like a Yahoo, but also too rational. It makes him dangerous, unnatural in their world. So they exile him.
Even the perfect beings reject him.
Yeah. He's heartbroken. He's eventually rescued by a Portuguese ship, captained by a very decent man, actually. But it's too late for Gulliver.
He can't go back.
He goes back to England, physically, but mentally, emotionally, he's disgusted by humans. He can't stand the sight, even the smell of his own family. He thinks they're all Yahoos.
So how does he live?
He ends up buying horses, spending all his time in the stable, talking to them, completely alienated from his own kind. It's a really haunting end.
Wow. So stepping back from the narrative, what are the big takeaways? What are the core themes Swift is hammering home throughout these voyages?
Well, first and foremost, it's a brutal critique of human nature, isn't it? He just relentlessly strips away our pride, arguing that fundamentally maybe we are driven by these base Yahoo-like instincts.
Yeah, that comes through loud and clear. And tied to that, the critique of society and government.
Absolutely. From Lilliput's petty court politics to the flaws Gulliver describes to the King of Brobdingnag, Swift shows institutions as just reflections or maybe amplifiers of our inherent flaws.
There's also that constant tension between reason and passion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are the Houyhnhnms pure reason actually ideal? Or is their lack of emotion, their coldness, also a flaw?
That's a huge question Swift leaves us with. Is pure reason even desirable? Or is the human condition, this messy mix of reason and passion, just inherently broken? He doesn't give easy answers.
No, he definitely doesn't. And the whole idea of perspective is crucial too. How Gulliver's physical size changes everything. His power, his view of morality.
Exactly. It makes truth itself seem relative, shifting. What's important in Lilliput is ridiculous in Brobdingnag. It makes you question if there's any fixed objective truth.
And Gulliver himself,
mm-hmm.
We talked about him being naive. He's kind of an unreliable narrator, isn't he?
Deeply unreliable, often. He reports things quite plainly, but he often misses the deeper point or the satire is aimed at him.
Which means we, the readers, have to do the work. We have to see the critique he doesn't always grasp.
Right. It makes the satire even more effective because we feel like we're figuring it out alongside or even ahead of Gulliver. The whole journey for the reader is this descent, really.
From what seems like fun fantasy.
Into some pretty dark existential places. It leaves you with this sense of radical doubt about everything, progress, civilization, humanity itself.
It really does force you to look at our own world like an outsider, doesn't it? Like Gulliver, seeing things fresh.
Mm-hmm.
What absurdities would we notice in our own societies?
Well, that's the enduring challenge of the book, I think.
Ultimately, Gulliver's Travels remains this incredibly bold, unflinching look at human folly. Maybe the lesson is that the hardest mirror to look into is the one showing our own capacity for absurdity, for cruelty, pushing us to keep examining ourselves.
Yeah, its power is that it still disturbs us, still provokes us. It makes us question what it even means to be human nearly 300 years later.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.